You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
For the last time to Connecting the Dots live as a live streaming broadcast. This is it. This is our final live streaming show of Connecting the Dots. It's also our apparently today is the final live streaming everything for everything on Redbox Media. We're still going to be around, but we will be around starting next week as a podcast. And so the podcast, Connecting the Dots, will be available. That'll be out there. You'll be able to download it or listen to it over your computer on the web, the same way you listen to the live show, except it'll just be in podcast form. And so we will continue to be providing you with audio excitement. As a Catholic, talking about life, the universe, and everything. However, we'll be talking about life, the universe, and everything once a week rather than Monday through Friday at this time. And you'll be able to listen to it whenever and wherever you like, as long as you have access to the technology to listen to podcasts, which I presume you do, or you wouldn't be listening to the show right now. So that's what's happening. And so we are here today with Mr. Douglas Aloysius Patrick Francis
Xavier O'Brien.
Xavier St. Gianamola Mary O'Brien. If you're super Catholic, you have Mary somewhere in your middle name.
Right.
Typically, though, that's like if you're like taking a name in religion. My priest's name is Father John Marie. And so
that's a nice name.
Pretty super Dominican name. Well, that's his. I don't know if that's his given name. Apparently, Dominican priests like take a name in religion. So Father Michael Sweeney was, to my surprise, it turns out he's a Western Dominican province priest who I love. But apparently his given name was like Bernard or something. So, but I've always known him as Father Michael. So it was kind of a jolt to try to wrap my mind around Bernard after I'd known him for like 10 years as Father Michael. So anyway, we're here with Doug O'Brien. He is the very last co-host on our live streaming show. So
it's an honor.
Wear it well, you know. How's it going?
It's going well. It's going well. Can I complain?
Good.
Weather's been nice in Chicago, you know. Time to get out the mower and cut down the dandelions.
Did that yesterday?
Feeling kind of sad about it because I'm one of the people that actually am not bothered by dandelions at all.
I don't mind dandelions either, and I don't mind buttercups. In fact, I deliberately mowed around the buttercups so that we would get a ton of buttercups later.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
I did, however, shed the green blood of Gaia when it came to the dandelions. I just went out there and it was mass slaughter, thousands of blades of grass plus the dandelions cut down.
Well, it offends my wife so much because many of our neighbors, not all, but many of our neighbors around us have these beautiful green golf course like lawns and I adamantly refuse to put anything that would kill the dandelions.
I don't blame you. I like dandelions. I like
watching seeing the bees on them and you know.
Yeah. Dandelions are important for bees, and bees are important for everything.
Exactly.
So yeah. So
I'm not a golfer, so I don't like.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Yes. There's something weird and unnatural about manicured lawns. So I'm with you on that. But felt good yesterday to go around killing so many blades of grass, and boy did it need it. It was like our lawn was like ridiculously shaggy with like grass that was in some spots it was going to be like, you know, a foot high or something. So I had to, because I literally haven't, this is the first time I've mowed the grass since last, maybe October, maybe even September. I'm not even sure. Because it just, you know, the rainy season started in October. Right. We have had the wettest October till now in the history of Seattle, ever since they started measuring rainfall.
And, you know, and that really says something when you.
Yeah. I mean, when it's, you know, we're talking about Seattle and it's like the rainy Seattle year. So I'm just, today, the sun is out. My big plan, actually, as soon as I'm done with this show, is to go take a walk up the street to our parish and go to confession, because I need to go to confession.
And we all need to go to confession, Mark.
Yeah, but I really need to go to confession. It's kind of been piling up, and I got to do something about it. So I'm going to do that, and then I'm going for a walk in an April wood near our house, and I'm going to be reading Up Jim River, a novel that I enjoyed a few months back, and I enjoyed the whole series so much, I thought I'm going to read this series again because it's really good.
Okay.
So it's a great sort of picaresque wander through the great Orion spiral arm of the Milky Way, and with lots of, you know, adventurous piratey sort of people, and, you know, assassins and spies and all the rest of it. So it's a lot of fun to read. So I'm just going to go back and read that again.
Well, good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's kind of it. And, I've got a big long series that I wrote for, the Catholic Weekly, which is the diocesan newspaper for Sydney, Australia. I decided to do a big, long series on the death penalty.
And do they have the death penalty there?
No. The death penalty, the last...
Interesting.
We're the only... I know.
That's why I asked the question.
China, North Korea, and, you know, to pick your Islamic despotism, whether, you know, Saudi Arabia or Yemen or Iran or Iraq, those are the countries that have the death penalty, and us. The United States. We are the last holdout in the first world on the death penalty. And the loudest champions of the death penalty are evangelical Christians and conservative Catholics. Conservative Catholics are the ones who are doing like the, you know, the theological brain work to argue to keep the United States on a list with North Korea, China, and Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So I thought that is just so ridiculous that Catholics are writing these justifications in flat repudiation of the express teaching of the magisterium.
Right.
This is not the church's teaching. This is the obsession of a small but unfortunately enormously influential cadre of what can only be described as dissenters against the church's actual teaching.
Right.
So I thought, it's ridiculous that I have to do this, but yes, I'm going to write a series that basically lays out why the church has developed its doctrine on this, and why it's common sense for Catholics to listen to the church and not fight the church on this. So it's kind of interesting because I'm an American writing about a problem that's essentially an American Catholic problem, but for a Catholic newspaper, and the part of the reason I'm doing it for an Australian Catholic newspaper, and part of the reason I'm doing that is because there's a venue where I can explore this topic at length, because I write a weekly column, so why not do a weekly series? But also because I've got an audience in Australia where the bulk of Catholics are going to go, oh, okay, that makes sense, because their country has already done this, right?
Right.
But at the same time, since it's on the web, anybody anywhere in the world, including especially the United States, can read it and hopefully change their thinking if they are still in support of the death penalty.
You did say a funny thing, though. You said conservative Catholics. I think most people would describe you and me as conservative Catholics. We're just not politically conservative.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm theologically conservative, but in this country, no longer am I something that would be recognizably politically conservative because I'm theologically conservative.
Precisely.
And that's I think when the church says something, you go, okay.
Right. Right.
And that's, for me, that's theological conservatism, but it sure as hell isn't American political conservatism anymore, because American political conservatives are, with the exception of abortion and gay marriage, are shockingly to me and scandalously to me, are at war with a great deal of what the church has to say.
Right. I would say that they actually represent, you know, something of a heresy that enters the church, right? Is it transmuting political conservatism as theological conservatism, which, you know, they're not the same.
They're not the same. And so we're living in an age right now where, to be docile to the church's teaching is in many ways to find yourself, you know, certainly. You will find yourself at odds, and we'll talk about this when we return, with the Democratic Party here in this country.
Yeah.
And the Democratic Party made that clear again this week. But you will also find yourself at odds with political conservatives. So we'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Doug O'Brien, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Doug O'Brien. And we were talking before the break about the way in which being theologically conservative, which means, by the way, here's my definition of theologically conservative. I don't even have to supply the words myself because they were given to me when I entered the Catholic Church. They're this: I believe all that the Holy Catholic Church believes, teaches, and proclaims is revealed by God. There you go. That's what I define as theologically conservative. So in the magisterium, I'm one of these people that rejected, when I came into the church, I rejected the notion that all you have to do is just listen to the church when the church tells you something that's a dogma, and the rest of it you can just kind of blow off if you don't like it. I don't buy that. I think that when the church says, here, do this, or if the church says, here, try to do this, or this would be a good idea, or this seems prudent to us, that's good enough for me. I'll go, okay, I will try to do that. And you're right, that does seem prudent. So even though the church doesn't, and this is, by the way, almost always, the church virtually never says you must believe or do or not do X. It's extraordinarily rare for the church to actually bind your conscience in that way. Almost all the counsel that the church gives comes in the form of prudential judgments and, you know, suggestions and kind of try to do this, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's good enough for me. And so I've never bought the approach to the church's teaching that's kind of like minimum daily adult requirement. You know, what's the absolute least I have to do in order to pass muster? And then I'll just ignore everything else that the church tells me, unless I feel like it. But that's the approach that is so often put forward. Just do, you know, do the very the bottom line minimum. So consequently, you know, when the church says things like, you know, we could just do without the death penalty. Yeah, it's not a dogma, but why do we need the death penalty? What good does it do? It's imprudent. The odds are pretty good that if you have a death penalty, you're going to wind up killing innocent people, and B, you're training yourself to be a people who deals with problems through vengeance. So if it's not necessary to kill someone, don't do that.
Right.
That's pretty much the church's approach to the death penalty. And I cannot for the life of me see what's wrong with that reasoning. And yet I run into, you know, Catholics who tell me we got to have the death penalty. It's super important that we go on killing people. Well, why? Well, because justice. Well, mercy. What about mercy? And, you know, I mean, there's even, you know, look at King David in the Old Testament. He's as guilty as you could possibly get, right?
Yep. Right.
Commits adultery and then murders to cover up the adultery. And God says, yeah, I'm going to go ahead and spare you.
Right.
So did God commit an injustice? Well, he's God. He can do those sorts of things. Yeah, but what the church says, you know, the church to whom Jesus said, he who listens to you listens to me, and he who listens to me listens to him who sent me. The church says, don't do this. So why is it so important to do this?
And precisely because we're not God, we should be merciful.
Yeah.
It's precisely because we don't know, right, that we should show mercy and not kill people. I'm not saying release criminals on the street or convicted felons or murderers, but I'm not sure what we gain as Christians or as a society that happens to include some Christians by killing people, especially with like what's going on in Arkansas right now.
Yeah.
Is it this race to kill as many people as you can because you're fearful that your drug will expire is an absurdity.
It's absurd. And it's grotesque.
And to laugh, I mean, I feel even bad kind of laughing about it, but it is really absurd. It is because we're racing to execute people, at least one of which, if not more, have stated their innocence and have requested an opportunity to prove their innocence before this happens. And yet here we are with Arkansas racing.
Yeah, well, we already killed that guy.
Yeah, right.
So now we don't have to bother to try to find out if the guy that we killed needed to be killed.
Right.
See, it's a time and money saver, you know. But that's the thing, you know. And we see what amazes me are the kinds of arguments that are put forward. So one of the ones that's put forward is, you know, what about the victims, Doug? Don't you care about the victims? They need closure. Yeah, well, the argument is we need closure, and closure consists of killing somebody.
So my conservative Catholic friends are using New Age psychobabble, closure?
Really? Well, here's the thing, you know, is the guy they killed yesterday in Arkansas in their rush to get as many people killed as possible before, you know, we let that poison go to waste, the guy they killed yesterday, the family of the victim wrote the governor and begged them to spare his life.
Right.
So all the people that are yelling and saying, well, what about the feelings of the victims? When that happens, the immediate response is the victim doesn't matter.
Right.
It's abstract justice that matters. Well, among other things, the victims say things like, I don't want another death on my conscience. This is not helping me. In fact, it hurts me to think that somebody is being killed in my name.
Right.
And the response of the death penalty champion at that point is, ah, screw the victim.
Right.
You know, I want to kill this guy because I've got some theory of abstract justice. And that's what really matters. And what it really comes back to in the end you have two approaches to taking life. You can approach the question of taking life by asking, when do we have to kill? And essentially what the church says is, with the death penalty, you don't have to kill. You don't, unless you're living in some third world hellhole where prison technology is so sketchy that it's really possible that some murderer is going to be, you know, sprung from jail. Say you're living in, you know, Yuma, Arizona, 100 years ago or something, and it's really possible that, you know, the gang could show up and, you know, shoot the sheriff and get the killer out of jail and then go off on another killing spree. Then you might have, you know, some reason to say, okay, maybe it is better for the safety of the community to execute the guy. But we're not living in Yuma, Arizona in 1862, you know?
And even then, that wouldn't have been an acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Even then, that would not have been an acceptable argument.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, you can see why, you know, so in terms of Bronze Age, yeah, what this always comes back to is Genesis 9, verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, his blood shall be shed, you know. And what you're looking at is a kind of a raw-boned Bronze Age situation where this is not an ideal that's being set out. This is a concession to human weakness that's granted, you know, to Bronze Age human beings. But the church has never looked at this and said, you know, the goal is to kill as many people as we possibly can on death row. That's what we want to do, maximize death. And what you find is that the early church did not, in fact, say everybody who is guilty of murder should die. What the early church and the medieval church and throughout the history of the church, what you find in the penitential manuals of the church are penances for murder.
Right.
Well, you know, penances for murder don't make a lot of sense if you're going to execute every murderer.
Well, and Matthew 25 doesn't make a lot of sense either. You know, when Jesus says, you know, I have the tendency to focus on feed the hungry, right? But he also talks about, and he visited me in prison. Well, yeah. You know, I would ask those people, what do you think Jesus meant? Like, wave and say, hey, how you doing, and walk on? I mean, the idea in Matthew 25 that Christ is commanding, and by the way, is commanding us to do, is to minister to those people who have fallen outside, you know, who have broken the law, right? And the state has appropriately used its authority to put them in prison. Mm-hmm. And that we as Christians, who likewise have committed sins against the justice of God, are called then to minister to them in prison, right, including murderers.
Right.
And this is a command.
Yeah. And this was, you know, this is something that's throughout the history of the church. So what the church has always done is it's, you know, up until very recently, the church made allowances for the death penalty, but it never held the death penalty up as some kind of an ideal.
No.
And that's how we got to where we are today, which we will resume when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien talking about life as Catholics. We'll be back.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Doug O'Brien. We've been talking a little bit. You know, I've been spending some time just talking about the death penalty. There are lots of other examples of what I would call right-wing culture of death priorities that are absolutely mysterious to me. Why? You know, the death penalty is one example of just an incredibly perverse commitment to something that no one needs, but for some reason it's like super important for people on the right to fight the church on this. And we saw this, you know, as well with unjust war. We still see this, you know, with torture, which will be back as an incredibly popular thing the moment Trump decides that he wants to torture somebody. None of those people have gone away that love it. And very few of them have learned anything from the horrors that were inflicted by the Bush administration. But in addition to that, you know, the reality is that you're also, as a Catholic, you're profoundly at odds with Democrats in the United States too. Although they're, you know, my empathy is with a great deal of, particularly what pro-life Democrats have to say, because they have a consistent life ethic. But the problem is, pro-life Democrats are, for completely mysterious reasons to me, are just on the butt end of all of the malice that the Democratic National Committee has. And that,
yeah.
So this week, you know, the DNC, faced with the worst president in the history of the United States and a Republican Congress where midterms are coming up in 2 years, and a Republican Congress that is absolutely bent on destroying health care for everybody but themselves, the DNC leadership decided now is a really good time to begin a witch hunt against pro-life Democrats. We really,
yeah.
It's all hands on deck. We need to stop Trump. How do we do that? Well, the best thing that we can possibly do is target one quarter to one third of our own rank and file for excommunication and do everything we can to drive them away. That's a smart idea.
Well, yeah, that's you know, a Democratic firing squad is lining up for the circle and saying, shoot. And as your token pro-life Democrat, and I think I've said on the show many times that I am a bona fide Democrat, worked on Capitol Hill, ran campaigns, and remain a Democrat today. And I'm also a faithful Catholic and pro-life with a consistent life ethic. I'm a supporter of Democrats for Life of America, a great organization, which I encourage people to be supportive of because they continue to fight the good fight within the party. But this past week was just it pretty much showed to much of America that my party is in complete disarray, can't get its stuff together, and seems to be on a suicide mission to ensure that Donald Trump gets a second term. And it's, you know, the beginning of this was, and here's the classic. The beginning of this was a Democratic unity tour, right?
Yeah.
We had the new head of the DNC, right? With Bernie Sanders together, they go to Nebraska and they go there to endorse Heath Mello, who is a running for mayor of Omaha, who is a pro-life Catholic Democrat. And, and shortly after their visit and their support rally, the extremists from NARAL complained, and Tom Perez, the head of the DNC, then responded in the cowardly fashion to those criticisms from NARAL and said, "Oh, we are unequivocally a party of choice, and it is a non-negotiable of the party." And he was then shortly thereafter joined by the senator from this state, Dick Durbin, who I might add, when he was a House member and was working on a combined campaign to help support him. He also was a pro-life Democrat, right? Who, wow. like many Democrats, over time shifted their position, right?
Right.
And Dick Durbin said the same thing.
Yeah.
Fortunately, some other Democrats with cooler heads and I think a more rational view of the world, who they themselves may in fact be pro-choice. Mm-hmm. Chuck Schumer, Bernie Sanders is not really a Democrat, but plays one on TV, and Elizabeth Warren all said that this is a ridiculous position. All it shows to me is that both parties have this, frankly, a blind spot, a dark, evil blind spot, which goes against life. With the Republicans, it is among many things, but not least of which is their view on capital punishment. And for the Democratic Party, my party, it is the treatment of the unborn. And it's sad. And then I think the challenge for all Catholics or any Christian or any person of good faith is to say, do you stay within your party and fight for its soul, or do you surrender to the other side or become an independent? And if you become an independent, there's something very freeing about that. The problem is that you lose a great deal of political influence and clout. And that's just a reality in our system. So, you know, it's ugly and stupid. And once again, Democrats show that maybe there's a good reason they're the minority.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it was weird. A number of Democrats who were saying, why are you such a single issue person on this? I said, I'm not a single issue person.
Yeah, you're not
on this. The absolutely, it was Tom Perez who was the single issue person.
Yeah,
he was telling, you know, pro-lifers who agree with him on 99 out of 100 things.
Right.
That's not good enough. And you can just leave, you know, if you won't knuckle under on this one thing. And it's like, what is wrong with you? And it tells me that these guys just aren't serious about actually getting rid of Trump. Or rather, what they're more serious about is the money that they want from Planned Parenthood and from NARAL and those kind of political action organizations.
Well, I think it's not so much money. I think what it is that they believe, like the Women's March and things like that, that the movement, that the pro-choice movement is the party's base, and they can't do anything to offend it. And when the extremists, let's just be honest, Planned Parenthood and NARAL are extremists on the issue of abortion, period. Just like the NRA is an extremist on the Second Amendment, right?
Yeah.
And one can understand rationally why they take those positions that are extreme. But part of being in political leadership is to not fall prey to the extremes in your own party, right? But to look at what is in the best interest of, in this case, the Democratic Party. And Tom Perez, I mean, what he really did, there'll be members, people running for office in red states, people who otherwise agree with the Democratic Party and who would help Chuck Schumer if they elected to the Senate, or Nancy Pelosi if elected to the House, who will never get there now and will have to refuse DNC support, because these nonsensical things that Tom Perez and the DNC have put out there as the position of the Democratic Party now will hurt them in those states, right? Or those districts.
Right.
And it's just, you know, and I say this as a Democrat, it saddens me Tom Perez needs to be replaced. Is that if the party is not going to be a big tent, I don't really like that phrase so much, but it needs, look, what makes me a Democrat is its economic principles, its view on the environment, its view on human rights. There's a lot of foreign policy. There's a lot of issues in which I agree with my party on. There's some I disagree with them on. But I feel very mostly comfortable with those positions, and less comfortable as a faithful Catholic with some of the positions of the Republican Party.
Right.
Now, there's an alternative. You have the American Solidarity Party, which is coming into its own. And here in Illinois, they're going to hold a convention here relatively soon. And I think that's a nice movement to keep an eye on. But the Democrats really are making it difficult for faithful people, evangelicals and Catholics and Orthodox Jews, to stay within the party when they hold these positions. And,
right.
And I think he needs to go. He needs to go.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's just, to me, it's just, it's so obvious that it's, you know, look, it's, guys, it's all hands on deck. The only thing that matters at this point is getting rid of Trump. That's the paramount thing to focus on strategically, is stopping this guy before he potentially, I mean, we're talking about somebody who he looks at things like a war with North Korea in terms of what will this do for my ratings?
Yeah.
that's crazy.
Well,
you can stop a guy like that. He's going to, he could kill millions of people.
You know, it looks like the Trump administration is continuing the Obama administration's, but we'll talk about this later.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we will. Yeah. And we will talk about this in the very last segment of the live stream version of Connecting the Dots, coming up right after this. We'll be back.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connect the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Doug O'Brien, and we have a caller. I believe it's Dan calling him.
Yes. You take Do you take a caller?
I take a caller. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Very good. What's on your mind?
So, I was calling in to say, I think that, I mean, I have to say I disagree with the most important thing about the Democratic Party being to put out Trump. I had to say that really the Democratic Party has to rebuild at every level, that they lost the whole nation. They have, you know, there is a 32 states that have two, that they control the entire legislature. Which 24 of them have a concomitant GOP governor in them, which, you know, this is massive. They have all three branches of government controlled by the GOP. This is massive losses over the Obama years in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Their only thing they were going to win in November was the presidency, and they lost that.
Yep.
So yeah. So when they talk, I think the most important thing for the Democrats is to start, in a sense, a rebuilding. And you know, if you look at the success of the GOP from the 80s forward, it was a very distinct grassroots effort between a combination of the moral majority as well as an extended attempt to get into the school boards, get into the local places, get into the states, and just rebuild the whole party that way. That's right. I mean, they have lost everything from the top to the court to both our federal government and then the entire state. They are not far from a constitutional convention being able to be called by the GOP.
Yeah. And they're talking about doing that.
But Dan, I will say this, is that the Republican success was because they spoke to what people actually believed. So that enabled people to encourage people to to have legitimate grassroots movement to go fill school board positions and city councils and village boards. And that became the recruiting bench. The problem that Democrats have right now, and I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying, is that they really, my party has decided to not tap people in what they actually believe. Someone like myself, who put, or Heath Mello, a better example, who is a pro-life Democrat, and is would likely win the Omaha, Nebraska mayoral race, is put in a national spotlight because of his pro-life position and the disarray it causes in the party. Is that the Republicans are very good at tapping into people who were center-right, religious, which represents a large portion of the country. And the Democrats have to likewise be open to those people, you know, devout evangelical Christians, devout Catholics, Greek Orthodox, Orthodox Jews, so they likewise can feel comfortable putting the D behind their name when they run for these smaller offices. And I think until the party is open to legitimate grassroots, and that's not represented by NARAL, right? The all the other extreme groups that seem to fill the pantheon of the DNC, is that when they open up to those groups, to individuals where they actually feel and believe, then the party will begin to rebuild itself. So I agree wholeheartedly with what you're saying.
Oh yeah, no, I'm you know, don't hear me at all disagreeing with that particular piece. I do think that extremism has I think it's narrow-mindedness. I don't think that there's actually a lot of leadership depth. I can't imagine that someone looks in New Jersey and tries to figure out why is it that we keep losing to why do we keep losing to a Republican every so many years in the GOP when the state routinely goes blue for every president, you know? So I think you're right. I think that there is a lack of state level talent for running campaigns at the in the Democratic Party. They didn't have. I don't know where they all went.
Well, I mean, I I'd say this, is that too many of them get talking points, right? Is it that you end up talking to nobody, right? Or you end up talking to the same 12 people. You know, I know a little bit about New Jersey. I know that New Jersey has, you know, they care about the environment there. You know, it's a very highly populated state. So clean water is a big issue. There's a lot of Catholics in New Jersey. You know, there's a lot of ways the party in New England and in the Mid-Atlantic states can rebuild itself. But when you have these talking points, which say that we are adamantly pro-choice or we're, you know, whatever, is it ends up driving too many people. They feel like they don't connect with me as an individual or me as a voter or me as a person who sits in a pew on a Sunday. And I think that's the problem the party has. And once they do that, they'll once again begin recruiting not just people for office, but the apparatus of a political machine, right? To maintain recruit.
The technique, let me just say, this is a technique of politics these folks are bad at. Like the operations of politics, like, you know, I call it organizing the picnic. They can't even organize the picnic, you know. These are not the people you would ask to do the family reunion this year. It seems that they can't, like, getting folks elected is really challenging. And once that becomes the goal, you know, then it's easier to, then they can start governing. Because they're governing from the last guy who got branded as an extremist, Obama, governed right of center. He was closer to Richard Nixon than he was to, any of the
chairman now.
Anyone else.
Well, you're right. I will say this. In this last election, the number of young people that walked by my house and talked to me about Bernie Sanders was incredible, right? Young people that would remind me to vote. There was a legitimate enthusiasm. And to put it in New Jersey context, I actually went for the guy that was running against Matt Rinaldo, put door hangers on people's houses in Metuchen and Edison, New Jersey, right? So, but to go out and get people to do that, they have to actually believe in the candidate, right? And I would say that you know, Bernie tapped something. It wasn't that people thought he was a brilliant foreign policy strategist. They felt that Bernie Sanders understood their problems. You know, wage stagnation, concern about the environment, dealing humanely with people of color and minorities and differing viewpoints. And that's what really drove his campaign. And you see the Democrats right now seemingly wanting to get on that path, but then stepping right off at the minute they're confronted with someone who doesn't fit the party's orthodoxy. And I think you don't get people to put door hangers on, you know, go door to door for a Saturday afternoon if they don't really believe the party cares about them or represents their views. And again, Bernie showed that you can do that, and leave it to the DNC to screw it up.
Part of the weirdness of the thing with Heath Mello was, it was like, seriously, you're going to blow up the entire Democratic Party over a guy running for mayor of Omaha, Nebraska?
Well, yeah. That's insane. You know, even, like, you know, so you would say that there's no, you know, that Nancy Pelosi is not shy about her support of abortion rights. She was the only one who's talking sense last weekend.
Right.
You know, she was only like, I've served with plenty pro-life people. That's what she said. Which no one would ever would, you know, you wouldn't see her. It's hard to find her as the, you know, but she, you know, she. And again, I've never been overwhelmed by her sense of politicking, the ability to get a deal done or anything like that. But she seemed a little bit more open to the idea of more friends and less enemies.
Right. Yeah. And by the way, when I mentioned, you know, when I say that the priority is getting rid of Trump, what I mean is, you've got somebody who's, you know, been in an automobile accident. What's the priority? Well, the priority is to make sure they can breathe first, you know. After that, you attend. After that, you attend to the broken leg, you know, and the rest of it. We got plenty of problems in this country, but the number one problem is a guy who seriously thinks that perhaps getting into a nuclear war with North Korea would be good for his ratings.
Yeah.
In a longer term sense of adjusting politics, part of this would be to create more parity in the state legislatures by 2020 because a census is coming. And that's not insignificant. That will determine gerrymandering. That'll determine how pretty much the balance of the legislatures and the congressional districts for the next decade. That's actually where I'm looking at, because that'll be the important thing coming up.
Yeah. Oh, it's critical. In fact, the Democratic Party has in each state has a committee that includes lawyers working on gerrymandering and all this redistricting work coming from the census. But like you pointed out early on in the conversation but if you don't have people to win those offices, right? If you don't have legitimate grassroots movements getting people in those offices, it's for nothing, right? The state legislatures in many states draw the boundaries.
Well, maybe we could get Donald Trump to draft a new constitution on a single space or double space single sheet of paper
with pictures.
Yeah, that's something to look forward to. You know.
Oh yeah.
Well, we are out of time. I want to thank you, Doug, so much for your contributions to the show. Dan, I want to thank you for calling in as well. It's such a rare occasion that we've ever had callers on the show, so it's a real treat to have somebody do that. And I want to thank all of my listeners. I want to thank Danny Head for his great work as producer of the show. He will continue producing the podcast as well. And I look forward to meeting you next time in podcast form. Thank you so much for faithfully listening all of these years. Bye-bye.
Farewell. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.